I'm Tom Clutz, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, y'all. Ooh, I'm gonna be all right. I really am. I want to thank Joe and the rest of the committee and all of you for allowing Julie and myself to be here with you and share with you. I have just been assaulted with your aggressive love, and it's going to take me a few minutes to recover from it. But thank you for letting me share with you, and thank you for helping me live one more day of happiness in a program that saves my life daily. You know, before I hope we can have a good time and share a little bit tonight. I get excited about life, and I love to be at meetings like this, but every now and then I am kind of overwhelmed with the seriousness of what we really deal with, and we are dealing with alcoholism, cunning, baffling, powerful, progressive, and terminal. And that means it always gets worse, and it'll kill you if you don't do something about it. And it almost killed me. And sometimes I think when we're laughing and having such a good time that we forget that there are those who are still so close to the problem that it's not too funny to them. And I certainly want to say right at the beginning that I remember well the times when things were not a bit funny in my life. There wasn't a funny thing about it. And I want to hold on to that because it's important. I don't want to get to the point where I'm so caught up in your beautiful love and caring and sharing and the wonderful way of life that we live that I forget the pain that goes on around us and the seriousness of that sign that is on the wall at our club rooms that say, I am responsible. Because there were people here like you who cared and loved and shared and were responsible so that when you found me, I had a way to find a new way of life and to begin a recovery. I got to share a little story with you that, you know, I'm going to do that every now and then just to catch my breath to get started. But I got to tell you, I got to share with you my baseball story because it's baseball season and the Braves were playing the other night and everything. And once upon a time, there was one of these outstanding fan baseball coaches and he had this young rookie on his team, kind of like I feel when I stand between Joe and these other people, all these delegates and everybody. And this young rookie on the team kept jumping up and saying, Coach, put me in. I know I can hit the ball. And the coach would say, sit down, kid. You're not ready yet, you know. And all throughout the game, he'd jump up and say, please, Coach, put me in. I know I can hit the ball and do good. And the coach would say, sit down, kid. You're not ready yet. But he was a good old coach. And he said, come here, kid. And he put his arm around his shoulder like this, you know, and he was saying, now listen, I want you to look up there in those stands. It says there's 40,000 people up there. And if I put you in and you strike out and mess up, they'll all start booing and hissing and stomping their feet. And I don't want you to be subject to a traumatic experience like that. Sit down, kids, you're not ready yet. But in the ninth inning, when the score's tied, like it always is in these stories, the kid jumped up and said, Coach, please put me in. I know I can do the job. And everybody said, give him a chance, Coach. Even the people on the other team said, put the boy in, you know. But the young rookie came up to the plate and sure enough, promptly struck out. And all the fans started booing and hissing and stomping their feet and throwing beer cans. And the old coach jumped up out of the dugout and ran over to console him, you know, and he said, wait a minute, Coach. He said, you don't understand. He said, they love me. They booing you for putting me in. All right, now. Now that we understand where to direct your wrath if this doesn't go right, I mean, there's a man that can stand it. I've been confused even amongst all this love and everything, being from the downtown group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Montgomery, Alabama, the world's finest group. I've been a little bit confused because the normal stereotype that I run into is some old mean, gruff, low-bottom, tough-looking AA bird that makes a talk, you know. And last night we had this sweet, ladylike, adorable, precious AA speaker. And I'm used to a sweet, adorable, precious, ladylike Al-Anon. And this morning... Boy, did we have a paradox there, you know? I've never seen a low-bottom Al-Anon. Woo! You people, you AAs that miss that Al-Anon and Al-Ateen meeting, really missed something fine. But I'm telling you what, I hope my wife didn't identify at all. Ooh, worst thing she ever did was try to dissolve an antabuse tablet in my coffee, and it wouldn't melt, you know, and I was saved. But, high bottom AA, low ballot bottom Al-Anon, and a teenager talking about God. You know, that just almost overwhelmed me. I couldn't stand it. But that's the beauty of our program, isn't it? That is the beauty of our program and the way that we can share. And it's fantastic. I'm going to tell you kind of like the book says, because if I had to describe myself to you, I would call myself an extremely conservative, far-right, radical, big book AA member. You know, if there was a John Birch Society of AA, I'd be in it. And I may say some things tonight that some of you won't agree with, and that's all right. That's your privilege. It'll hurt my feelings if you tell me, but it's all right. But if you ever, by chance, find yourself radically disagreeing with what's in this book, then I'm going to suggest that you just run like crazy to your sponsor, or you go to your meeting, or you do something, because the downtown group of AA in Montgomery, Alabama, and my sponsor, Big Tom, taught me that that's where the program is, and that is where you base your framework and your growth. And that's where you go back to in times of trouble, in times of peril. And that's what I try to do. So I'm going to share a little bit about how it was and what happened, and maybe some about how it is now. It's good now. Being here is good. Being here with my wife and a family and a job and all these beautiful things is good. I'm going to share a little bit. Basically, my message is that, yes, indeed, there are real, live, modern, 20th century miracles of God. I think that's the basic message of AA. I think when we read those stories in the back of the big book, and remembering when we read those, that particularly in that first bunch of stories, that nobody there was sober over about 4 years when those were written down right there. And the story is not a great deal of philosophy and theory and methodology, but it's a story of contrast. It's a story of a miracle of God working through a group of people in someone's life. And that's exactly what happened with me. Some of you want to be a little less spiritual and a little less philosophical. My story is just like this, that if I can get sober, darned if anybody can't get sober. Because I think anybody in the downtown group in Montgomery would, if I wasn't able to relive it all, and I can't, could share with you the terror and the horror that alcoholism wrought in my life. And I'm going to share a little bit of that with you. But first, I'm going to tell you another little thing I like, just to get me feeling good. Every time I start thinking of those spiritual things, I think of the first alcoholic. Y'all know who the first alcoholic was? The first alcoholic in recorded history. You can look this up in the ninth chapter, of a book called Genesis. The first alcoholic on the face of the earth was an old bird named Noah. And that's a fact. Noah got on that boat when all that rain came, and, you know, he might have gotten stressed because all them animals or something. I don't know. But the first thing Noah did when he landed that boat was he planted a vineyard. He became an agribusinessman and planted a vineyard. And the first thing he did when those grapes developed, look it up. The first thing he did was he made some wine. And then the book says he fell drunk and naked in his tent. Friends, that's not social drinking. and old Noah fell drunk and naked in his tent, but that's not all. Because one of his sons that had heard about Al-Anon, I think, one of his sons was into something called intervention. I don't know. But he saw his dad laying drunk and naked in the tent, and he went off and got the rest of the family, the two brothers, and he carried them in there. And the two other brothers, and the book says they saw the condition of their dad, and they turned their back and backed into the tent and covered the old man up with a cloak. Now, doesn't that sound like an Al-Anon turning their back on the problem and covering up for him? maybe since, you know, and doggone it, when the old man woke up, true to form, he cursed and banished the first son. And I like that because it lets me know that we're dealing here with something that we have a blessing that has plagued mankind since the earliest days. And yet, because of Bill and Bob and people like you, we now have a solution. There is an answer. And it's an answer that we have the opportunity to share with others. Well, I was thinking of that Al-Anon again, and I don't know why I got Al-Anon on my mind, but I guess it's because it's this four black belt Al-Anon looking at me right now with aggressive smiles. And y'all know what the definition of Al-Anonism is? It's the obsessive compulsion to do something about the drinking of a person with an obsessive compulsion to drink. I just want you to think about that sometime. But I was like that. I grew up in a little small town, much smaller than Cartersville, and my graduating class at Hainville High School had 19 kids in it. And there wasn't a whole lot of this stuff that they now talk about, peer pressure for us to drink. The boys at Hainville High School played football, basketball, and baseball and chased the girls. That's all the boys did. And the girls let us catch them. That's all the girls did. And we went into some of the lifestyles that exist now, but there was really no difference because shortly thereafter, you know, I went off to Auburn, and at Auburn, same thing. It's just maybe it's a little younger now with the kids in high school instead of in college. But I got off to Auburn, and very promptly, I found out that there was something different about me. For some reason or other, and it's really not important. The book talks in terms of an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind, but there's something about me that I just don't get along with ethyl alcohol. I don't get along with ethyl alcohol in any form. I don't get along with 60-year-old five-star Napoleon brandy. I don't get along with 12-year-old Tennessee sour mash sipping whiskey. I don't get along with Coors, Aquavelva, Rubby Dub, or Squeeze. I don't get along with any of it. And I got up to Auburn, and I set out on this path, a beautiful path. I would take any one of you young people and counsel with you and tell you about the beautiful path that my preacher and my teachers and Mr. Massey, our principal, and my mom and dad and grandparents, I was supposed to go to school and get good grades and graduate from an accredited college, preferably with Dean's List grades. And I was supposed to get a job with a large corporate structure, and through perseverance and sweat of brow rise unerringly to the top of the corporate status, you know. I was supposed to marry a pretty blonde girl from a wealthy family, an old wealthy family. And we're supposed to have a couple pretty kids and a two-bedroom brick with a two-car garage and two cars to go in it and, you know, be a deacon in the Baptist church. And, you know, I really wanted to do that. I really wanted to do that. But there was something else that I really wanted to do. And I don't know where this came from, except that it's just life. I knew that I needed to learn to drink like a gentleman, because drinking was part of all the patterns that I was looking at. I identified. My dad was the retired Army colonel, and identified with the colonels and their ladies sipping their cocktails at the officers' club, and identified with the suave Madison Avenue executives on TV with a patch on their eye and a white shirt, you know, drinking their martinis. And I identified, my favorite identification was sitting on the veranda in a white suit in one of those beautiful columned homes like you have around here, you know, sitting on the veranda under the wisteria, sipping a mint julep out of a cut glass crystal, you know, type of, you know, and having a liveried servant come bring it to me, you know. And I also had these fantasies about, the fact of the matter is, the kind of drinker I was more like what in South Alabama is called basic redneck. Because I also identified with these guys that would come in on payday evening, you know, come out of the piney woods and come in and fling open the front door of some kind of little honky-tonk and go in and grab them a bottle of whiskey and break the top off and drink it about half down and grab some blonde by the hair and drag her in the back room, you know, to give her a drink, too. And you know, I really identified with all of that. And so when I got off to Auburn, I didn't do good. I did very, very poorly. I remember that that after the first quarter, I was out celebrating my grades. I'd made four D's and an F, you know. And I got involved in an incident, and the dean of men asked me not to come back to Auburn University. And I went home. I went back to Hainville, Alabama. And the little old ladies at the Hainville Baptist Church, they kind of looked at me a little bit strange and funny. But I knew they still loved me. I knew they still loved me. And I still loved me. And my parents understood that I was just going through a period. And in fact, the matter is, we had a custom. We fine young gentlemen from the fine old southern homes in the fine little southern community. We had a custom that we'd go out all during the week, and we'd what you call sow your wild oats. And then we'd come to church on Sunday and pray for crop failures, you know. And that's what we did at Hainville, you know. But Y'all sure have taught me a lot, because I had a lot of erroneous information programmed into me. They were talking about periodic alcoholics this morning. I know what kind of alcoholic I am. I'm a period alcoholic. I can't drink, period. But I didn't know that, see? And here I was out of school, and I worked a little bit, and I got down into New Orleans where my dad was stationed then. And during the year that I was 18 years old, I was arrested 2 times for just plain old drunk. Except my plain old drunk always turned into plain old drunk plus teeth, hair, blood, eyeballs, blunt instruments, guns and knives and other complications, because I didn't know about keep it simple. All I knew about was rowdy and disorderly and things that were really foreign to what inside of me really wanted. You know, the pain of my alcoholism, I think, really, as I begin to look back at it, the pain wasn't the hurt in me. Not the physical hurt, not the mental hurt, not the emotional hurt so much. And the pain wasn't what I was doing to the people that loved me. The pain was the recognition that I was violating my own values, because I didn't want to do what I was doing. And I didn't know how not to do those things. And certainly I didn't associate it with having a disease. I certainly didn't associate it with a sickness. I associated it with a badness, with an immorality, with a lifestyle that was wrong. And y'all taught me that I needed to be a sick person trying to be well, not a bad person trying to be good. You gave me that. And with that dignity and with that humanity, I was able to begin a recovery years later. It continues on a day at a time if I'm painstaking about maintaining a spiritual program by touching base with God as I understand Him each day. Anyway, I got back on the track. I went to the University of Alabama and matriculated into there, and really nothing was different. I did discover what is called building up your enablers. I did discover what's called overachieving. So that when I got to the University of Alabama, instead of doing bad, I did very, very good. God blessed me, I guess, with a fairly good memory before I got brain damage. And I was able to remember things, so I could put down the right answers on tests. And I made very, very good grades. Very, very good grades. And people liked me. You know, I got on the dean's list, and I got people that were just thinking. I tried to be the best student at that university, because I knew already, by the time I was 19, that I needed to do very, very good things on the one hand, because I was going to do very bad things on the other hand, and I had to kind of balance them out. What I was doing just as a survival technique was building up my own enabling system. People that would bail me out of trouble, starting with my mom and dad, and broadening it to principals and teachers and professors and lawyers and judges. And for about 2 years, I did good. I did good. I won awards in the ROTC, and I did good. But in between the doing good, there was the alcohol. And not every time that I drank did I get in trouble, but every time that I got in trouble, I had been drinking. And I already knew this at age 19. I knew there was something different about me. Later on, I discovered that what's different about me is that I was born a half pint low. And now you have to think about that a little bit. I was born a half pint low. And I would have to replace that half pint before I'd get back to normal, before I'd get back to human being status. I had to put that half pint in there. But I couldn't keep that half pint there. The half pint got me back to average, and then I went on. And I began to violate my own values. I'll share with you the type of thing that I was doing, and certainly it has nothing to do with the insanity of alcoholism. The insanity of alcoholism is the fact that I did these things over and over and over. But on this particular night, we had been down at a place called the Birchfield Hotel drinking beer, which was a traditional thing with me, you know. And I had met this most stimulating, fascinating, cultured, wonderful person in the bar. I always met brain surgeons and astronauts and electronical engineers and people with patents in foreign lands, you know. Dr. Silkworth once talked about him and called them lower companions. But I met this lower companion, and when the last call came along, you know, a craving was flung on me for some fried catfish. Now, you can talk about obsessive compulsive if you want to. I understand that kind of vocabulary if there are any doctors out there, but I just had a craving flung on me. I still have cravings flung on me. there's a basic difference. Now, I've had a craving flung on me about an hour or so after I'd go to bed at night. Julie would tell you, I'd get up, put my clothes on, and if I wanted orange sherbet and ginger ale, I had to go to 6 7-Elevens to find Canada Dry ginger ale and Barbara's orange sherbet, I'd go. But today, I have some respect for the law of the land and property rights and torts and all that kind of stuff. But in those days, if a craving was flung on me and I wanted something and you had it, honey, you was in a world of trouble. And a craving was flung on me for some fried catfish. And Tuscaloosa was a much smaller town in those days, and everything was closed, and I was all in a tizzy about where I was going to get some fried catfish. And my lower companion said, you know, my uncle is a catfish fisherman on the Warrior River, and he's always got a deep freeze full of that catfish. We could probably go over to his house and get some and take it back to the dorm and fry it up in electric skillets and keep drinking these little Budweisers, and we'd have a good time. And I said, let's go. And we got to the uncle's house. We got to the uncle's house, and it was dark. And it became obvious that there was nobody home. I welled up all my 2.5 years of Dean's List grades and all my co-ed academic excellence and did the only logical thing. I kicked the door down. And we went on in the uncle's house and got the catfish out of the deep freeze. And as we were exiting the premises, I believe they later called it, this guy said, you know, this is my mean uncle. I said, yeah? And I got my gun out. Now, I like guns. I like guns before I drank, while I drank, after I drank. I still like guns. I think Smith and Wesson made everybody 9 feet tall, you know? And I got my gun out, and if there are any psychologists out there and you want to talk about guns being an extension of your male virility and all that, I don't want to hear it. I just like guns. And I got my gun out. And I'd been on the ROTC pistol team, and I took that .38, and I very carefully blew a couple pictures off the wall. And I shot the couch a couple times, and I got the TV set right in its one big gray eyeball. Bam! Because I was thinking, with all that intellectual intelligence that I had welled up there in 2 universities, I was thinking that when the FBI and the CIA and the Tuscaloosa City and County Police, the Alabama Department of Public Safety, and the Canadian Northwest Mounties, when they came to investigate this grand, you know, happening, they think it's some real live interstate desperado like Joe that done it. You know, they would never think that it was some fine straight-A student out at the university that did it, would they? When I woke up in jail, I found out that, among other things, I suffer from impaired judgment. Now, I need to explain impaired judgment. Impaired judgment is not doing stupid things. Impaired judgment is doing stupid things thinking they're smart things. You know, I woke up in that jail at age 20. I guess it was 20. Could have still been 19. I don't really remember. But I had every single solitary feeling and situation that I had with my last drunk. I had guilt, I had fear, I had remorse, I had anxiety, I had that black cloud of dismal doom that followed me around, I had a hangover, and most of all, and the speaker last night talked about it, I had that big hole right in the pit of my stomach that the cold wind blew through. Y'all closed up that hole, and you keep it closed for me every day. And I sat there in that jail, and I hurt. And I hurt real bad. And then my enabling system bailed me out. And we paid the lawyers and paid whatever else had to be paid and made restitution. My daddy did that because he loved me. And I'm not knocking enabling either, because enablers saved my life. They may have done some of the things that we talk about enablers doing, but time after time later on, enablers literally saved my life by hauling me off to emergency rooms and by calling ambulances and by doing those sort of emergency medical things. So the end of the short of that story is that the Dean of Men asked me not to come back to the University of Alabama, and the judge asked me not to come back to Tuscaloosa, and I didn't. That's interesting. That's the full circle. That's some of the little side issues and miracles that we find in this program. I didn't go back to Tuscaloosa for 12 years. And then I went back to Tuscaloosa to do exactly what I'm doing right now, to speak at an AA meeting in that little down under the hill Tuscaloosa AA club room. And I went in after dark and left before daylight. I don't know what the statute of limitations on grand theft catfish is, But I wasn't about to find out, you know. And here I was, 20 years old, kicked out of two universities, definitely off that track that I told you about, violating my own values and hurting people around me, and it hurt me. And I joined the Army, and that doesn't have a lot to do. But what I was doing was, I guess, that innate thing that we sometimes call a geographical cure. Let me share something with you. Probably the only thing that... In fact, it's a biggie. You better get ready for it, because here it is. Wherever you go, there you are. Wherever you go, there you are. And wherever I went, there I was. And so the Army was just a replication of the same sort of behaviors, the very, very goods and the very, very bads. I got two letters of commendation signed by general officers, and that was very, very good for a young Vietnam-era trooper. I got two court-martials, balanced right out. It's any way you look at it, you know. And I got out of the service and somehow wangled an honorable discharge, and my family was out in Oklahoma then, and came back home, got into the University of Tulsa, and began pursuing that elusive goal. And I managed to kind of halfway get back on the track. I only got arrested one time in a whole year. And I was going to school, and I met a beautiful young lady. She was not from that rich old family, but she made up for it in other attributes, if you know what I mean. And we got married, and I graduated with my Dean's List grades, and I got a job with a large corporate structure, Sears and Roebuck by name, and started rising unerringly to the top. And we had us a little three-bedroom brick, and we didn't have a two-car garage, but we had two cars, and we had a couple beautiful kids. And most anybody except some of y'all would have said, look, there's a young man who has everything. And indeed, you would have been quite correct. You see, I had everything in that little dream, except I had something else. I had alcoholism, cunning, baffling, powerful, progressive, and terminal. And that means it always gets worse, and it'll kill you if you don't do something about it, and I didn't. And it got worse. And things on the job got bad, and things at home got miserable. Let me share with you just the way it would be. There was something strange in me. I still don't know exactly how it worked, but some days I got off at 6 o'clock in the evening, and some nights we didn't close until 9, so I'd get off at 9. But about a half of an hour before I got off, the thing inside of me would know. And about a half hour before quitting time, all of a sudden I would begin to get more nervous than I was a few minutes ago. And the perspiration would break out on my brow and on my lip right here. And I'd begin to tremble a little bit and wring my hands like that. And I'd just get all uneasy and everything. And I'd get in my car and I'd go down the Yale Avenue and I'd take a left on Admiral, and I'd go into the Hollywood liquor store, and I'd walk in the door, and the manager would say hi to him, and I'd feel all reinforced, you know, and validated, because he trusted me as a valuable friend and customer, you know. And my hand would get about that far from that pint bottle of Seagram 7, and a brown vibration would come shooting out of that thing, and it would run over my body, and I'd take a deep breath. And I'd feel good, and I'd feel at peace with the world, and at peace with mankind. And the perspiration would dry up, and the tremors would go away. And all those butterflies in my stomach would fly off to some Al-Anon meeting somewhere, you know. And I'd go on home and whoop into my house and come in my front door and walk back to my kitchen. And I'd take a straight shot while mixing my mixed drink. And I'd go down and sit in my big chair in my living room and throw my feet up on my footstool and watch my TV and order my woman around. That's what I did. And then far in the night, often, far in the night, I'd wake up sitting in that chair. Television set over there all gray and squiggly going, shh, you know, looking at me like that. And I'd say to myself, self, you poor, hard-working young executive. You're just working too hard. You're too overstressed. You need to relax more, you know. You've fallen asleep in your big chair. You hadn't played with your pretty children. You haven't had dinner with your family. You hadn't gone to bed with your pretty wife. You hadn't done nothing. You've just fallen asleep. And I'd get up and stagger back and pass out in the bed. And then in the morning, I'd wake up every morning sick. So sick. And I'd go in the bathroom and I'd start out wanting to shave or something, and I'd get my toothpaste allergy. You know, every morning when I went to brush my teeth, I changed toothpaste time after time. It's something about toothpaste that made me retch and gag. And it made my eyes and my head hurt, you know. And it made me sick. And I'd sit there and have my toothpaste allergy attack, and I'd say, "Why'd you do it, Tom? Why did you do it?" And they were paying me while I was working to make decisions. That's what they pay managers to do, you know. And I'd sit on the side of the bed, and I could not even decide what suit to wear or what pair of shoes to wear. And I'd hurt. And I'd go to work, and I'd just walk and pace. And people thought, I learned one thing. It's called on-the-job absenteeism. I learned how to... I'd get a clipboard or something. I'd walk all over that three-storied big giant store, and I'd go into unit control and out to the warehouse and through the storerooms and past the cashiers and through credit, and people would say, "Look at it, Tom Claus work. Woo!" But I couldn't stand still, you see. I'd just walk in. But somewhere about noon, I'd start feeling all right because I was young and I was healthy, and the physical aspects of alcoholism are the last to strike most people down. And they were the last with me. You see, my alcoholism is you taught me, a complicated type of thing. And it's physical, it's mental, emotional, it's spiritual. And it attacked me backwards from that. See, the first thing that it attacked was my spiritual life. A very important part of the life of the grandson of a Baptist preacher and a person that has been reared in the church like I had and understood the values. And yet I at one time just had to reach a basic decision. And that is, if your drinking is bad enough on Saturday night and your hangovers are bad enough on Sunday morning, you got to reach a basic decision. You either got to quit drinking on Saturday night or you got to quit going to church and Sunday school on Sunday morning. And of course, you know what I did. And then I would sit at home, and Sunday mornings became the worst part of my entire life because my family would go to church. Everybody that I knew were going to church. And I'd be sitting there, and every station on the radio would have gospel music, and everything on the TV would have gospel programs. And I'd be sitting there identifying with a song that Johnny Cash sang years later. It was called "Lonesome to the Bone." And I felt lonesome to the bone and cold and sick and alone and frightened and hurting and bad. And then I'd drink some more, and maybe I'd get to that point. And then I'd go beyond it. And I did this over and over and over. I don't know. It was not good. It was not good. I was extremely verbally abusive of my wife and children. I used to worry about that. You know, everybody seems to talk about that. Why do we hurt the ones we love? People want to write theses about that. And I finally figured it out. We hurt them because they're the ones that are there. You know, it's hard to hurt somebody that lives across town, but the people right there in the room with you, they're the obvious ones to hurt. And I love my wife, and I love my children. Beautiful blonde daughter, beautiful little redheaded son. And I hurt them. I hurt them emotionally and mentally. And I hurt them with pains and scars that only now that can I really realize some of the stuff that alcoholism in our family caused. It's a family illness. It's a family disease. And those little kids caught their share of it. Let me share with you the type of person that I was real quickly, because you helped me not to be this way anymore. I'm not well. There was a period when I was sober about 5 years that I was one more well rascal. I want you to know I was so well integrated and so had it so all together. And I also began to feel just a little bit divine because I was out helping people and I was fixing drunks. But I know now that I'm an FHB and I always will be, a fallible human being. And I have lots of faults, but I try. I try, and I can identify with other people who hurt. This was a 3-day weekend, and I don't know what had preceded it. Julie doesn't remember it the same way, remembering she's sick too. And anyway, it's kind of like this. I think that I went into the kitchen, and I told her that I was going to take our little 2 or 3 or 4 month old infant son and hold T3 by his feet and bang him against the wall until his brains ran down the side of the wall. And then I broke a bottle of 57 sauce or something in the floor to graphically show what it was going to look like. And you know, even a little budding Al-Anon can't stand that type of mental emotional abuse, and she snuck out of the house or something. And hey, don't ever go to Oklahoma if you ever plan to drink again. You know, they got some weird laws out there. I had been arrested by then in lots of places for what they call public drunk, and even hurt my feelings, but in other places for what they call common drunk. But they got a charge out there called private drunk. That's where your wife calls the police and they come into your own house and arrest you in your own big chair. And yeah, she called them. They knocked on the door and I invited them in. Alcoholism, cunning, baffling, powerful, progressive, and terminal. That means it always gets worse and it'll kill you if you don't do something about it. And I hadn't done anything about it. And you know what alcoholism had taught me? Remember the pretty little story, the little fairy tale, the little sort of on the front end, chapter 8, you know, page 83 that I gave you? I had learned how to go to jail. Isn't that interesting? A person who grew up in an environment that just going to jail was, you know, that just wasn't in our lexicon. And I had learned how to go to jail. And when those detectives came in and they said I was under arrest, that my wife had signed a warrant, no big deal. Except that I knew that you go to court the next morning in the clothes that you wear to jail the night before. And I said, fellas, here I am with my Bermuda shorts and shower shoes. Why don't you let me dress up a little before we go to jail? You need to go to jail dressed like I am now. Then they'll fan the fine gentleman, you know. And so I went back to the base. They said, okay. Now, I'm not saying I like cops, and I'm glad that we've got a city councilman or something here and not a judge, because I'm not too fond of them rascals either, but I do understand them, you see. And I went back in my bedroom because they said, okay, and I went back in my bedroom and I got my reserve pint out of my sock drawer and I took a long pull on it and I said to myself, self, why don't you have a little fun with the Tulsa Police Department? I don't know how many times I've read about this, and I don't know how many times I've taken a deep breath and said, thank you, God, because it didn't end up the way I've seen it happen in other places, because I got my shotgun down, and I took it out of the case, and I leaned around the door jamb, and I said, hey, and the detective said, hey. I said, I've got a loaded shotgun back here. You know, it's a pump. And they said, uh-huh. And I put my gun back in the case, and I sat down on the bed and worked on my reserve pint and let their imagination work on them. And about a half a pint later, I decided I had enough fun with the Tulsa police and I was going to escape. And I cut the screen out of my bedroom window and I was ready to flee out through the side yard. And I looked out in my yard and there was a SWAT trooper with his shotgun. Well, you got it, friends. They had barricaded and evacuated the neighborhood. And I surrendered live in living color on the 6 o'clock news. Just like that. Joe, some people think I got fired from Sears and Roebuck, but that's erroneous. I called up from the Tulsa County Jail and resigned. And I got another announcement for you. I want you to listen carefully because I appreciated our speaker last night so much. And that's this, that it's important. An old boy who's totally out to lunch upstairs now, bless his heart, he said this at an AA meeting one time, and I was the only one in the room, I guess, that heard it, but I carried it with me forever, and I'm going to share it with you. Nobody in this room, including Al-Anons and Alateens and guests and VIPs, nobody in this room ever has to take another drink unless they want to. That's interesting. I didn't know that in a lot of my life. And the other side of that coin is this. Nobody in this room ever has to go any lower unless they choose to. You see, I'm what you call a low-bottom drunk. Bad, low-bottom, sick. And if you're sitting here tonight sober, you don't ever have to go any lower than you are right now. But if you choose to, you can. I had a lot of opportunities. I had been to AA during some of this. I went to a few meetings. I read your soap operas in the back of your book, and I said, wow, they're better than As the World Turns, you know. And I read the Serenity Prayer, and I memorized the steps, and I picked up some literature, and I said, isn't this wonderful informal, non-directed group therapy in action, helping these poor, sick folks? Juliet fell in amongst those bunch of people called Al-Anons. I didn't know much about Al-Anons in those days, and the downtown group in Montgomery, Alabama will tell you that I love Al-Anons. I wanted to throw that out there. But I mean to tell you, there was a time in my life when I didn't exactly love Al-Anons. The fact of the matter is, if you'd asked me what Al-Anon was, I'd have said a bunch of nosy nagging bitches. That's what I said. When Julie fell amongst them folks, the first thing I found out was that they had an unlimited printing budget, because you never seen the literature and pamphlets again began to appear around my house, you know? I went in, was having my toothpaste attack one morning, and opened the shaving mirror, and 44 questions fluttered down into the top. Really? And I went in to get some ice water. I had an old gallon Mogan David wine jug in the refrigerator that I drank a lot of ice water in the morning in those days. And taped on the side of my water jug was the 12 and 12, you know. And I promise you, whap, a way of life popped out of the toaster one morning. Just jumped right out of it. But, you know, I could forgive them all this unlimited printing budget. And then they began to work on my wife's mind. And the first thing they taught her, I love. They taught her acceptance. Now, I'm here to tell you, acceptance is joy. Because she didn't pour out my whiskey and throw things at me and beat me while I was asleep and stuff. She accepted that I was sick. And then they taught her detach with love. Detach with love. I like that even better, because we was detached and love's what I wasn't getting. And I like detach with love. But then they taught her the cruelest, the most insidious and diabolical scheme ever crafted up in the dark recesses of the feminine brain. They taught her, don't take up for your alcoholic. Don't cover up and make excuses for him. Don't alibi for him. Let his problem come to the front where it can be dealt with in the bright light of day or some sort of stuff. One morning my boss called. Here I was, fair-haired young executive. My boss called and says, where's Tom? Is he sick? And Julie said, no, sir, he's drunk. My problem arose and surfaced. That's when I condescended to interview a psychiatrist. I was a psychologist for a while. Didn't like psychiatrists. But I interviewed Dr. Smith for a few months. I even interviewed him in his own office. And I'd go in and educate him for a half hour a week, and I think I talked Dr. Smith an awful lot about a young, you might call, systematic, heavy-drinking young executive type. And, you know, I'm not making excuses, or I'm certainly not condemning anybody that tries to help people that have a problem. Because I know that Dr. Smith cared and wanted to help me. And I also know that there was not a chance for him to do it. Because the ground rules that I established wouldn't have allowed him to help me, even if he had been some sort of miracle helper. Because I told him right up front, we're not going to do anything about my drinking. We're going to maybe make me a more well-adjusted drinker, because that's what I wanted to be. And I never drank before the meetings, but I drank right after them. See, I went to AA in those days, too, I told you. I never drank right before your meetings. Had great pride that I didn't drink before your meetings. But I drank right after your meetings. And some old-timer could have been sitting in the back and probably did say, he's not ready yet. And I wasn't ready. But things got bad, and they arrested me and hauled me off to jail, and I ended up with a choice. A good choice. Love these kind of choices. Oh, boy, I love. I ended up with a choice of maybe going to jail for a long time or voluntarily being court-committed. That's a strange phrase, isn't it? Voluntarily being court-committed to the insane asylum. Well, I selected for the insane asylum. Alcoholism taught me a lot. Alcoholism taught me that you are improving your status in life when you go from the isolation cell in the Tulsa County Jail to the lockup ward in the insane asylum. That's an improvement in status. Even if the first night that I was there, I got up to go to the bathroom and somebody got in my bed and went to the bathroom. Yeah. I can see it now, sitting there, locked up in that room. A couple drunks over here talking about the crazy people over there, locked up in the same room, you know, crazy people over there. Yeah. And then I really graduated in status, because I graduated over to a an open, incorrectly labeled AA ward. Incorrectly labeled AA ward. But they were trying. This was back a long time ago. And they were trying, and it wasn't bad. And they did have a meeting, and the institutional people came in. Maybe that's somebody asked me this evening about working with institutions, and I said that my sponsor liked it. Maybe that's the reason that I did it so heavily through our institutional committees for about my first 6 years in the program, because the institutional committee came in on Thursday nights and carried the message. And after about 5 weeks, I was even elected head drunk. I was the inside guy that introduced the outside speaker that came in, you know. And then 4 days before I was to be properly staffed and released and have my rights restored, 4 days before, a craving was flung on me to escape. I want to talk to you just a minute about the insanity of alcoholism, because to me, this typifies it more than any of those crazy things I did. You see, anybody that gets under the influence of alcohol, anybody, young people, old people, Al-Anons, anybody that gets under the influence is going to suffer from impaired psychomotor coordination. That means they're going to stumble and fall and wreck cars and drop things and have accidents. And they're going to suffer from impaired judgment. That means they're going to do stupid things while they're thinking they're doing smart things. That's just the nature of the drug we call alcohol. But the insanity of alcoholism is typified by what I'm going to share with you. For at least 5 weeks, there had been no chemicals in my body at all. I had graduated from the old Thorazine shuffle, you know, a long way back. But I had been chemically and drug and alcohol free for at least 5 weeks. Medically, that's sober, friends. Medically, that's detox, friends. I had been totally withdrawn for 5 weeks. I had been exercising. The guys in the ward there had been going down, and we were doing a little jogging, and we were doing what they call physical therapy, and we were doing recreational therapy, and we were doing leisure therapy, and we were doing occupational therapy. They thought in Oklahoma that alcoholism was indigenous to a leather craft deficiency. But anyway, I've been doing all these things and eating good food and sleeping, and by any medical stretch of the imagination, I'm sober. But alcoholism's a disease that does not disappear with alcohol in our system. In fact, maybe that's when alcoholism really does its thing, is when the alcohol is not in us and we choose to reinduce. Because the craving was flung on me to escape 4 days before my rights were to be reestablished. I have observed all my life, if you get put a suit on, because we had our Sunday go to meeting clothes, and if you get a clipboard and a pencil and put a suit on and walk fast and look down, you can go anywhere you want to. And I got the chart out of the nurse's station and a pencil and put my sports coat on, and I trucked right on out the door and over to the admin building, which was off limits, and was walking up the steps. Now, this is back in the days before the federal courts and everything, with bars and locks and guards and walls, you know. And it's hard to escape, because Julie will tell you, there ain't no trees in Oklahoma. And this insane asylum sat up on a hill. And some poor beggar would go out the gate and run for about 2 days, and they'd watch him. And then they finally say, go get the poor sucker, you know. But I went on up those steps, and as I was going up the steps, there was a man coming down the steps, and I said, sir. He said, yes, son. I said, sir, I'm a graduate student from the University of Tulsa in psychology, and I'm out here trying to get a part-time job to help these poor, afflicted people. And since it's drizzling a little bit and the bus doesn't come for about an hour, do you think you could give me a ride into town? He said, sure, son, hop right in. As we were going through the gate and we were waving at the guard, I looked over his sun visor, and that rascal was a Tulsa County deputy sheriff. That's right. He took some poor beggar in, but he took me out. And then here's the insanity. Here is the insanity of step two capsule for me. He let me out, and on this side of the street was the Greyhound bus station and 40 miles straight shot to Tulsa. Home, freedom, money, family, food, luxury, life, whatever. Whatever. Dreams. On this side of the street was a little brown, shingled, rustic, one-story building with a gorgeous sign in baby blue neon right on the side going blink, blink, blink. And it was saying, Coors on draft. Coors on draft. I said to myself, self, Here you are, been in the insane asylum 5.5 weeks, getting well for your wife and children and mankind as a whole. One draft beer won't hurt. And I was passed out before I finished escaping. And when I finished escaping, I basically, under duress and threat, kidnapped that infant son and fled across state lines, and just terrible, terrible things happened. Finally, I had to surrender and go back and get my rights restored, and that was even worse. And for about 6 months or so, the family moved on to Alabama, and they didn't want to, and it was terrible. I was teaching school, and life got bad. Because for about 6 months or something, I did not drink. I stayed dry. I stayed dry out of fear, and I stayed dry out of not wanting to go to the insane asylum. And I stayed dry for my mother and dad and Julie and T3 and Tammy and all the little black kids that I was teaching high school English and literature to. And I stayed dry for everybody else in the world. And I felt like some sort of conglomeration of Henry Kissinger and Florence Nightingale, you know. I was running around, but inside I knew there was a bomb going tick, 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 and it was going to explode, and it did, and I got in a gunfight with my best friend, and we shot 20-some-odd holes in a 12-by-60 mobile home on the inside at each other. And then I went through a bad period. You know, I've heard that the... That's really weird. I've heard that the chains of alcoholism are invisible until they're too strong to break. Did you hear that? The chains of alcoholism are invisible until they're too strong to break. I can quit any time I want to, but I don't want to. But the reason it got bad is because along in here I wanted to. I desperately wanted to. And I couldn't. I couldn't. I was hauled off to hospitals. This is where I've talked about the enablers that continually saved my life, because I would go back into the back room of that mobile home we had. I had taken the screen windows out and covered them with aluminum foil so that it was pitch black dark back in there. Any psychologist around or MSWs or anything want to talk about returning to the womb? I just went into my room. And I'd go back in that room and I'd have a half-gallon bottle of I.W. Harper and no conscious intention to come out of that room. And most of the time, consciously, I did not. My sister or my mother or earlier on maybe my wife or somebody would pick the door or break it down and haul me off to different hospitals. Not for what I call treatment, but for what I call detoxification or acute emergency care. Because they'd pump my stomach and they'd give me things to revive me. And then I'd go home and I'd drink again. And I got to that point in life where I was 100% completely, absolutely miserable. 100% completely, absolutely miserable when I was not drinking, and I would try not to drink. And I was also 100% completely, absolutely miserable when I was drinking. And that left me only one place to go, and that was passed out. And passed out was good. And passed out was safe. And passed out was comfortable. And passed out was dark. But there's one problem with passed out. It's called come to. Because I always came to. And it was worse. And it was bad. Let me share with you what happened real quick, because a lot of things happened in there that are too painful for me to even remember. I really do not remember the last 2 years of my drinking very well. And I was so darn sick. And this I can't even figure out. And I talked to people about it. I can't remember the first 6 months to the year that I was sober either. Don't remember any of the first 6 months that I was sober. People talk about their first AA meetings and when they met their sponsor and all that kind of business. Blank. But some new people, bless their hearts, called Al-Anons, have been taking care of my wife a little bit. And some new people called Al-Anons on a holiday in their own car picked up this sick, suffering, sorry piece of mankind, unshaven, dirty, thrown up, wouldn't ever go to the bathroom in the bathroom. And they picked me up in their own car on a holiday and carried me off to a new hospital, to a new doctor. This guy, bless his heart, was a new type of bird I hadn't run into before, called a recovering alcoholic doctor. And he didn't believe in giving you a whole lot of pills and a lot of shots and letting you fly around for a few days. He believed you ought to shake and sweat and appreciate your sobriety some, you know. And we went on a battle that lasted for 2.5 months. And I would get out and go AMA, as they called it, and run amok and buy a gun and shoot something up. And they'd capture me again, haul me back to the hospital. And he'd say, "You'll be drunk the day you get out." And I'd say, "You're lying." It'd be the next day, you know. And this went on. And then here I was. I want to share this with you. If your spiritual battery ever gets weak, hey, share this with me. If you get into one of those points where you feel all alone sometime, or dark, or hopeless, share this with me. The third day of the third hospitalization in that particular series, and it was in December, it was in late December, maybe January, I don't remember. But it's cold and it was dismal, and my dad came to see me. And he looked down, and that was strange. Dad was a beautiful man, beautiful, mature Christian man. But he had developed in his own mind his own brand of tough love. Never really got into Al-Anon, but came up with the same way of life. And he looked down at me and he said, "Son, I've got some bad news for you. Here I was, no job, no one car wrecked and the other one broke, and the payments not made on either one of them, bounce checks everywhere, didn't know what I'd shot holes in, little old ladies at the Haneville Baptist Church didn't love me anymore, and I knew it, and my self-concept was so bad I would only go to the whiskey store and the bootlegger after dark." And Dad looked down at me and said, "Son, I've got some bad news for you." I almost laughed at the man. He said, "Julie's taken the children and gone home to Oklahoma and probably won't be back." Now, my dad loved his grandson named Thomas Howard Clauss III, T3, more than he loved anything in the latter part of his life. And I could see the pain in his eyes that told me that he didn't think he was going to get to see that little grandson very often anymore, except maybe on visits. And he said, "She probably won't be back. And we had no need for that mobile home you were buying, so we called the finance company and they've come and picked it up." See, when I lost my home, I literally lost it. There was nothing there when I got out of that hospital but a pile of concrete blocks and a power pole and some oil drums. And then he said that great statement that had chipped several of my teeth, but now I appreciate it. He said, "Son, I love you because you're my son, but I don't like you." And he did an about face and left. I followed that man to the door of that little hospital and stood there in the door, big beautiful lake down in front of it, the water supply for the city of Tuskegee, Alabama. And I'm going to share with you just what happened. All my life I had heard that God helps those who help themselves. Friends, that ain't the way it is. That's not so. That's not what it really says in the big book where it says, "Came to believe that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism." The first and biggest human power is self. God doesn't help those who help themselves. God helps those who admit they are helpless. And I did what so many drunks and what the big book talks about. I stood there at that door, and somewhere in the depth of the slight amount of humanity that was left in this wreckage of the disease of alcoholism, I simply cried out, "God help me." And I stood there at the door looking at that lake, fully prepared to just run down and drown myself. Wanted to, would have, had the right... I had the right motivation to do it. And many do. Many do. Alcoholics don't commit suicide while they're drunk. They commit suicide when they're withdrawing on about the third day. That's when they leave the hospitals and that's when they jump out the windows. And I was going to run down and drown myself in that lake. But I said, "God help me." And a feeling came over me that not to not do it, but before I did it, to touch base with a Baptist preacher. And I went to the phone book and I looked in the phone book. And there were two Baptist churches in Tuskegee, Alabama. And I'm crazy. And I'm insane. And I'm alcoholic. And I'm suicidal. And I'm massively depressed. And yet I'm so full of false pride and vanity and ego that I knew that one of them was the Black Baptist Church and one of them was the White Baptist Church. And I was darned if I'd call a Black Baptist preacher to save my soul before I committed suicide. And I was too proud and too vain and too insane and too sick to go ask the attendants that were black which was which. And I stood there going crazy. And I walked over to the door and a man walked in the door and I opened the door and I let him in and he walked on down the hall. And a little old black lady sitting right over there minding her own business all the time that I was going crazy looked me dead in the eye and said, "Isn't that Reverend Butler, the Baptist minister?" I said, "I don't know, lady, but I'm going to find out." And I followed him down the hall, and indeed he was Reverend Butler, the Baptist minister, but that's not all. This was some time ago, and in those days, not all preachers, and even today, really understand our disease, and particularly understand alcoholism and AA. But this one did. This one went to lots of open meetings and referred people and worked and went to Al-Anon. Yeah, Reverend Butler and I shared together, and something went away. And before Reverend Butler went away, here come that weird recovering alcoholic doctor. He said, I just was riding around and thought I might stop by and see you. It wasn't his time of day to come. And Dr. Carl and I shared, and something went away. And before Dr. Carl left, here came George and Clara B. from the Tuskegee AA group. Beautiful people. And they said they were just riding around, thought they'd come check on me and see how I was doing. And before they went away, the phone rang, and it was a young alcoholic named Buddy, who was 32 in the Tuskegee AA group. And he said he just thought he'd call and see if he could come over and check me out and take me to a meeting in Opelika. And I said, okay. And he did, and something went away. All five of those people are dead today. All five of them. Reverend Butler died 6 or 8 months later, a mature, healthy, long, beneficial life. Dr. Carl never really got sober and died from after effects of not being sober in cardiac surgery. George had a stroke. Clara couldn't stand the pain and took her own life. And Buddy died drunk at age 33. All five of those people were there when God wanted them there for me. And I don't understand that. But I share that with you to help you. If you ever waver and wonder about the power of God as I understand Him in this program. God helps those who admit they are helpless. I stood at the turning point and cried out with abandon, God, help me. You know? A little later that doctor came in and said, you can't win the war until you get out of the foxhole. And I know there's some people here that are fairly new in the program, and there may even be some who are resident in treatment programs. You can't win the war until you get out of the foxhole. Treatment as I know it is what's called discovery. AA, as I know it, is what's called recovery. And you do that out in the real live world. In the real live world. And one day I had to go out in that real live world, and I went to the downtown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get the best sponsor in the world, and I love to talk to you for an hour about Big Tom. But, of course, we can't. Big Tom was in that dangerous 16th year of sobriety then, and he knew that he had to go to lots of meetings, and he let me take him. And you know what? I kept that old man sober through that dangerous 17th year. Bless his heart. And at the end of that 17th, that year, he gave me that silver dollar, because one day at a time, through no fault of my own, probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Through no fault of my own, one day at a time, I had stayed sober that year. But God could and would if He were sought. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage your own lives. We always talk about the 12 steps of chapter 5. We read the 12 steps. Let's talk about the ABCs of chapter 5. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage your own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if He were sought. You know, for a couple of years, And it was that I did not understand the live one day at a time. I now believe that that is the key to a successful, happy, one day at a time life. Still an FHB, a fallible human being, but being able to deal with a disease called alcoholism. And I was riding along one day, and I thought I was too darn smart to live it a day at a time. I thought I had too much education, that I could fool with computers and projecting the future and budgets and forecasting and all of that. Until it dawned on me that every great religion and every great philosophy that anthropologists have ever been able to identify in some way or the other have endorsed that same simple statement, live one day at a time. You know? How did God take care of the children of Israel when they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years there? One day at a time, gave them that manna from heaven. Some of them didn't trust Him, thought they'd store a little bit up. But it's fall, and every day they get a nice new supply. You know, when the Master walked the rocky shores of the Sea of Galilee and gathered the people unto Him and preached that beautiful sermon that we call the Sermon on the Mount, and those of you that really understand your AA history will remember that the biggest part of the spiritual part of our program comes from the Sermon on the Mount in the book of James. When the Master gathered the people together and taught them on the hillside, He in Matthew 6:24, in the King James foreign language, said, "Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof." If you look it up in a translation called Today's Living Bible, it says, "Live one day at a time." And when we join hands in about 3 or 4 or 5 minutes and pray the Lord's Prayer together, we'll run right across a little line that I've said 1,000 times, but we need to pray it together, and that is, "Give us this day our daily bread, one day at a time." And that became the key to this whole program for me, and I wanted to throw that out in sharing with you. You know, since the whole focus of this meeting is to see and to share, I want to close by sharing one other little story. When the Master walked the rocky shores of the Sea of Galilee and did His good things, He came as the answer to a lot of pain and suffering. It was His job. And He had a friend who was in another group. The friend was called John. John was in a group in another little town. John found himself incarcerated, a situation not unknown to alcoholics. And John was incarcerated over in another town, and he got a couple of the guys in his group, and he said, "Hey, go check out the Master and see if He is the one who is to come or if there is another." And the guys went over and they got the Master and they said, "Are you He who is to come, or is," John wants to know, "or is there another?" And very much like the slogan of this meeting, very much like our slogan to see and share love, the Master didn't get involved in theology or doctrine or methodology or theory or philosophy. The Master said this, and this is something I would challenge you to do when those outside who don't understand our illness take their cheap shots at us. And they do. In many professions, and don't understand yet. And it's our job to carry the message. The Master said, "Go and tell John what you have seen and what you have heard." He said, "The blind see, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the lepers are clean. Go and tell John what you have seen and what you have heard." And when you leave here, and when our guests leave here, if they ever question as to whether people can get well from the progressive and terminal disease of alcoholism, just look around and tell these people, "Go and tell what you have seen and what you have heard." I think all that we're going to share this weekend, and certainly all that Julie and I are so grateful for and will be a part of our lives forever since you've let us come and grow in your garden, I think all of that is the result of something else the Master said. He said, "I have come that you might have life and have it more abundantly." This is what we enjoy. And I love you.